Stephanie Tan, but I am Marge Montgomery, and I'm an Al-Anon, a very grateful member of Al-Anon. I can't begin to tell you how much this means to me. It's one of the nicest things that's ever happened in my Al-Anon life, and for this I'm grateful. Thank you.
I'm not going to take up but one more minute of your time either. But we had a little gal get up here Thursday night and give a dynamite talk, and I understand that she's celebrating 8 years of sobriety today. Vicki, would you stand and let us say happy birthday to you? And on a more personal note, the man that I'm married to, John G., today is celebrating 20 years of sobriety. John, would you stand? Now I'm going to turn this meeting over to your chairman for tonight, Tony Jones.
My name is Tony Jones, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Let's open this meeting in the usual manner with a moment of silent meditation followed by a string of the prayer, please. Serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. This is how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunate. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. I did, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us, but there is one who has all power, that one is God. May you find him now. Joanna Z. from Costa Mesa, California. You know, I've tried, I guess, for about 2.5 days now to meet the lady, and I finally got to meet her this afternoon at dinner tonight. And, you know, I really wanted to meet her and sit down and talk to her just a minute or so to, you know, just so I could introduce her, you know. But, you know, I think that we can be assured of one thing. I've never heard the lady talk, and I never heard her tape. But I feel sure that we can be sure of one thing, that this lady does have a dynamite story to share with us tonight. And I don't think I'm going to take up any more of her time. I know she's anxious to get up here. So with that, I give you Joanna Z. from Costa Mesa, California. Joanna.
Hi there, my name is Johanna Zakaria, and I am an alcoholic. Before I start, I'd like to start at the very beginning and thank the committee as a whole for the very great privilege of being asked to come out here and share this roundup with you, because it really is a privilege to me. And I want to thank the gals who have made this weekend so pleasant for me. I'd like to thank Margaret and Vicki and Mary Jo, and I know I'm going to forget someone. I'm going to feel bad for another 24 hours about it. Barbara, I've had a nice time here. It's hard to go somewhere where you don't know anyone. You know, there's something, as I know you can imagine, a little awkward. You're not sure about it, and I have been made absolutely at home. I've never been in Atlanta before. I've never been in the South at all. And this has been one of the most pleasant weekends I have ever spent, and I want to thank them for that. I am someone who has had to learn what a privilege it is to be asked to do things in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, that is not something I came by naturally, as I said in my first meetings. You know, it's all part of the things we learn. I never even expected to stay here, much less do anything. Because what I thought when I sat in my first meetings and looked around was something a lot different. What I sat in those first meetings and looked around and saw was a lot like what I see tonight. You know, it never changes because it really can't. And what I saw as I was new in those early meetings and I looked around with a group of people and they looked a lot like you. You know, they were, I thought you were all dressed up and that you looked really nice. You know, I was dirty and I didn't smell good. And I had walked in off the streets of Long Beach and I had been in that condition for a long time. And as I sat there and looked at you, see, I saw you laughing and talking to each other the way we do in meetings. And I was sick, and I couldn't stop shaking. And it seemed to me, although it could not have been true, but it seemed to me as though all of you knew each other. And I didn't know anyone here. I didn't even know what I was doing here. Very naturally, it seemed to me as if I was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, that had already been the story of my life, and I saw no reason to believe that this was going to be any different. I have had to learn what a privilege it is to have anything to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I am really glad to be here tonight. I'm glad when it gets right down to, I'm going to tell you, I'm glad just to sit in a meeting of AA one more night. You know, I never could have imagined what was going to happen in my life when I first sat down in one of these chairs. And essentially that's what I am here to talk about tonight. I came from a perfectly normal Irish Catholic alcoholic home. And the results were probably predictable from the beginning. You know, we never think so. I was born in Kansas City, and I grew up in Sumatra, Indonesia, and I got sober in Long Beach, California. You can tell there's a story there, but not the one I'm here to tell. I don't spend any time talking about those years I grew up, and I always used to say it because, you know, we all end up here anyhow. What difference does it make? And someone else finally got me honest enough to admit that I find it difficult because it is so painful. It was an alcoholic home with all the anger and the violence and the resentment and the unhappiness that there can be in homes like that. And so really that's why. But I like to take time to talk about the attitudes and the way I looked at the world as I grew up. Because, you know, our stories are really always a story about our attitudes and the way we view the world. And when I was a kid, whatever else that was a Catholic home. And there were a lot of people in my life when I was a little girl. There were a lot of nuns and priests. There was all this family of relatives, my parents, people that sat with me. And they talked to me about the difference between good and evil and right and wrong. You know, I look back today and I know they were just trying to teach me how to live. But what I remember about all of that is the way I took it. Because sometimes it's possible to sit in meetings, at least where I come from, and listen to a lot of stories about people that grew up angry and rebellious and in trouble from a very early age. It can begin to sound like a requirement for membership here, and I wasn't that way. You know, I listened to those people, and I bought what they said. I wanted to be good. You know, I wanted my family to be proud of me. We all have fantasies when we're kids about how we want to be. You know, when we're all grown up, we all do that. And when I'll tell you, when I was a little girl, I had one too. It was naturally enough a little different. For a lot of little girls, that fantasy is to be a singer or a model, an actress. Those are the things that look glamorous when you're a kid. And what I did was read through Butler's Lives of the Saints. And when I was done, I picked out the one that I liked the best. And that was how I wanted to be. This was an active thing with me. And the one that I liked to look up the best was Joan of Arc. Now, I was real impressed with this woman. I thought she had it all. You know, she saw visions, she heard voices, She was involved in great events. She was a woman in charge of a lot of men. I thought that was pretty impressive. I still do. But this was an active thing, and I, of course, forgot about it as the years went by. And I was sitting in a meeting, and something someone else said from one of these podiums brought that memory back to me. And I sat in that meeting, and I thought, my God, even then, what a sick mind I must have had to have thought that Joan of Arc was having a good time. You know, they burned her at the stake. How good could it have been? But that was my attitude. See, I wanted to be good. And I picked up a lot of ambition. I wanted to amount to something. And the only way I ever knew to do that was going to be to do well in school. And I always did. I am one of those people that went through school and I did well without having to try very hard. And at the time, I naturally thought it was because I was so smart. I'm not someone that ever thought I was dumb, you know. And I don't know about that. You know, I look back today and what I am certain of is just that I have always been someone who has found it easier all the way along to turn to books and to turn to things, rather than to turn to you, to turn to people. People have always been difficult for me. That is often true today, but it was certainly how I grew up. And I had a lot of emotional problems, but I'm someone who never got into any external trouble. We moved back up to Long Beach just before I finished high school. And I graduated from a Catholic all-girls high school that June. And I remember how I felt that June when I graduated. I remember how the world looked to me. It looked good. I had all these hopes and I had a lot of dreams. I knew precisely what I wanted to do and exactly how I was going to get there. And I enrolled that fall at Cal State Long Beach with a major in the sciences. And things fell in place for me there for a period of time. And then, of course, something had to have changed for me to be up here tonight. And that change was a simple one. You know, I simply began going to some of these college fraternity parties. And it was a big change. You know, only someone who went to these Catholic girls' schools is going to understand how radical a change these fraternity parties were. But it was at one of those parties that I had my first drink. The guy was with my date, turned to me and asked me if I wanted a drink. And I would bet whatever the circumstances might have been exactly, I bet a lot of us began drinking in a similar way. You know, it was a group of my peers. I looked around, looked at me like everyone else was drinking, and I turned to him and I said, sure. You know, I can remember I did not stand there and I didn't think about it. My family is full of alcoholism. It has been fatal for some of us, but never me. You know, it is never going to happen to me. And that was the way I felt. And the next question, he asked me was what did I want? What should he bring me? And I set up a pattern right there that night at that party that I have broken only with difficulty here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was the immediate overwhelming desire to be cool. I didn't want him to know that I didn't know what to ask for. You know, I was naive. I was young. I didn't know. And I turned to him and I said, y'all bring me whatever looks good. And that's just what he did. You know, he brought me a tumbler of slow gin. And that was my first drink. It's never been real hard to figure out what he was thinking about that night. And I finished that off and I had a lot more. And I began drinking that night at that party precisely the way I was going to stop drinking, crawling on my hands and knees just 11 years later. You know, I drank that night until at some point I blacked out, I passed out, and I'm sure when I came to sometime the next morning that I was remorseful, sick, and humiliated. I am sure that's how I felt. And yet I was never going to drink any other way. You know, I've often wanted to be able to talk about what happened inside of me when I began to drink. And for a while I thought it was important that I do that I'd be able to express that in words. And it's still hard for me. You know, what I do know is that in these rooms, I really don't need to put any effort into it. You already know, you know, that's why you're here too. It felt good. you know. And what I know to say is what it says in our big book in the doc chapter 3 in the doctor's opinion. It says there that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And I don't know a better way to say it. I never want to forget what I have done to get a hold of that effect time and time and time again, because it became a way of life for me almost from the very beginning. It goes on, and Cleve read it last night, to say that after a period of time, we are no longer able to differentiate between the true and the false. You know, our drinking life comes to seem the only normal one. And I experienced all of that from almost the very beginning. I began carrying these pints around on campus because, see, what it had done for me is make it possible for me to loosen up, to talk to people, to party, get along. I had never been able to do any of those things. I grew up very withdrawn. You know, I'm someone who was so shy, it hurt inside all of the time. And so for me, just like it was for you, one way or another, it was an answer. And it was an answer I began turning to on a daily basis to make the business of living easier for me. I thought it was the best thing I had ever found. No one could have told me where it was going to take me in just a short time. I was drinking on this campus, and a little time went by, and this was the 60s, and it was a time on college campuses everywhere where there was a lot of radicalism, a lot of demonstrations, a lot of political activism. And these were the people that I was attracted to, that I was drawn to, I began to spend my time with. And what I am telling you is that my values had begun to change. You know, what I wanted for myself, the things that seemed important had begun to shift. And you know, whatever our stories are, and I got sober in speaker meetings, so I've heard a lot of people share their stories. What I know to say is that I have never heard anyone yet talk that didn't talk about changes in their attitude, you know, in their drinking, and then one more time again in their recovery. And my attitudes began to change, and I began to spend my time and do things with a different kind of people. And a little more time went by, and I began using drugs. That was going to be a big problem for me, too. I was arrested shortly thereafter on that campus, and in one of these demonstrations, and that was not a bad thing, you know, that was a good thing. It was a prerequisite of the times that you get busted somewhere for something. If you, at least in California, if you're going to be cool, you had to get picked up. That's the way it was. And so so that was not bad. There was a lot of notoriety associated with it. They put all our names on the front page of the Press Telegram. Now, that's largely because nothing ever happens in Long Beach, but I knew my father wasn't going to see it that way, and I was loaded at the time. I didn't feel all that bad about it, you know, and I once heard someone say that alcoholics are the kind of people that would rather have the cops here than be bored, and so there was a little of that mixed into it. And I didn't think about it much until I was bailed out late that night by a group. And then I thought about having to go home and having to face that hard Irish father and try and explain to him why I was in trouble again, because this hadn't been the first time. And rather than do that, I waited till the next afternoon when I knew that man wouldn't be there. And I walked in that house with a couple of cardboard boxes and emptied out a few drawers, and I left. And I was never going to live any other way until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I moved from Long Beach down to Huntington Beach, and that's a distance of about 10 miles. I've always been a little envious of people that have those drunk logs where they come to on a plane on the way to Paris, you know, or New York. You know, 10 miles is as far as I ever got. And that's because I always found it so hard to get up off the floor. I lived in Huntington Beach most of that next year, and I always talk about the room I moved into because that was never going to change for me. I was always going to live in places like that. It was the wrong side of town, and it was dirty, and it was cheap, and there were a bunch of us living there. And I remember laying on the mattress on that floor those first nights and looking around that little place, and all I can tell you is I had not been raised to be comfortable in a place like that, and I'll tell you how I felt. I felt absolutely at home. I felt as if, for the first time in my life, I was finally free to do and to be whatever I wanted. And I was going to believe that for a long, long time. Over that next year in that little place, I got a lot sicker. And before that year was out, I had moved back into Long Beach to start running those streets. And of that period in my life, all I can tell you is that before I was 21 years old and legally able to buy a bottle for myself, I needed to be here. There isn't anyone who could have told me that, but I needed to be here. Before I was 21, I was a chronic alcoholic. I was drinking heavily on a daily basis. Before I was 21, I had come to an locked ward out in Norwalk at the state mental hospital as a suicide. I had, of course, dropped out of school. I had become unemployable for all intents and purposes. There were going to be times in the years ahead when I would come up with some little job I held for a few weeks, a month or so at a time, and I lost them all. I lost them because I would show up drunk or loaded, or I just couldn't get in there anymore. I would drift away. I didn't understand how to go about the business of living. I have never known how. And I found a simple solution for me, and that was to begin moving in with what became a long line of men. I moved in with anyone who would just take me in, and then I stayed there until I was kicked back out, because that is how it always went for me. And I know, especially those of you who may be new, that it sounds as if I am just talking about the circumstances of my life, and that's not true. What I am really telling you is simply that one way or another, I have always said, you do it. You buy it. See, you fix it. You take care of it. You cover for me. You know, you love me. I can't. And the doorway to freedom for me here in Alcoholics Anonymous was that when I came here, there were those who said, this is your decision to make. These are the steps that you must work. It's up to you now. And I feel like I walk with a lot of freedom today, and I know that is where it came from. But of course, we don't know these things in the past. It's looking back that we see the pattern. And so the years continued in that way, and by the time I was 23 years old, there had been several more arrests. I was a lot sicker. I was helpless, and I felt hopeless. By the time I was 23 years old, not only did I have a drinking problem that had me in a lot of trouble most of the time, I was a heroin addict. And the only thing I had to say from these podiums about how I lived in those years is just to tell you that I am someone who has learned everything I ever want to know about shame and degradation and humiliation and remorse, because that is a dirty way for a woman to live. For a long time after I got to you, I wanted to say that it was conditions and circumstances that made me into the things I became before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and at a meeting, someone finally told me, you know, you're going to have to learn how to take responsibility for yourself. And he was right. No one ever twisted my arm. I can remember sitting on the west side of Long Beach early one afternoon, staring at the ground between my feet and thinking to myself, this is how it feels to sell your soul. And I can't stand up here tonight and tell you that I cared, because I didn't. I felt old, and I felt all used up, and I felt all burned out, and 23 years old is young to feel that way. You know, all I know to say is that if you are an alcoholic, sooner or later, it's going to take it all. Now, it may be fast. It was fast for me. Or it may be slow. It may be another kind of story altogether. But sooner or later, it's going to take it all. You see, it hadn't been that many years since I walked away from that Catholic girls' school with all those hopes and all those dreams, all that ambition. And there I sat, incapable of doing anything to change what had happened to me. I have never found it easy in a lot of ways to talk about those years of my life, because those years are a story that isn't pretty, and it's sordid, and it went on like that for a long time. But this is the only thing that I have to give. I don't have some other thing to tell you. Now, those years were a story of being in and out of the city jail. You know, the the drunk tanks. It was not something exotic, you know, it was pitiful. It's a story of being in and out of the free clinics and the county health centers. You know, I came to again out at Norwalk, again on a locked ward as a suicide. The sheriffs had brought me in there in handcuffs. Those years were a story of being in and out of the blood banks and the pawn shops over on the west side of Long Beach. You know, it was a story of being in and out of all those little bars and those little hotel and motel rooms up through town. And that was how I lived. It was the very best I knew to do. And there were times when a condition of probation I had was that I attempt to get some help. And there were times I did that very briefly twice. And I've looked at that, and I think there's a lesson in it worth repeating because I never got any help. I used to walk out of there feeling a lot worse than when I had walked in, and I didn't know why. And I look back now, and, you know, for those who are addicts, it is possible to use that for a lot of things. And there has never been anything in my life I would not use. I have always been able to put out what I thought you needed to see to get what I want. And that has never been a measure of my cleverness, but it has always been a measure of my dishonesty. And so what I would do is sit there, and I believe these were well-meaning men. I know they were. They wanted to help me. But I'll tell you what I wouldn't do. I wouldn't talk about how much I was drinking. I wouldn't say that I couldn't stop. I didn't know that then. There wasn't any way I was going to talk about how I was living if you didn't already know. It is no wonder I never got any help. I have learned everything I know about honesty, sitting in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, listening to you be honest. That is how I have learned. I have never, never been honest. You know, it says, In step 8, if we are willing to look carefully over the patterns of our lives, we will see those attitudes there from a long time back, and they have always been there with me. I will tell you how I learned about honesty. I sat in those meetings as a newcomer, and I listened to you be honest. I'd watch you open yourselves up and be real vulnerable, and I couldn't understand how anyone could do what you were doing. I came here with a lot of walls up. And what I had learned when I was a kid is that if I don't let you know what I am thinking or how I feel, there is no way that you can hurt me. And I couldn't understand why you were doing it. But I'll tell you what I watched. I watched the people come over you after the meetings and hold you. I watched you begin to change and you were feeling better. And that is how I learned. I had to watch you show me how. I have learned absolutely everything I know about how to live by watching you do it for me so that I could see how it's done. I have needed to see it. I, of course, didn't know these things then, but it's not as though I didn't know there wasn't something wrong. It is not possible to live the way I was living and not know there's something wrong. I just never knew what it was. What I thought is that I was schizophrenic or I was psychotic, and I thought sooner or later someone was going to diagnose me and then they could give me something and that would fix it. I didn't know I was going to have to wait to sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous to find a name for my disease. And so time went on, and that's how I lived on those streets. And it was ugly, and there isn't anything about it even today that I find funny or that I find amusing. It was heartbreaking. And I went some months ago to sit at a meeting in a little step house called Beacon Street in San Pedro. And it's a little step house on the waterfront over there. And it's not a very sophisticated meeting, but there were the kind of people sitting there with 60 days and 90 days and a little tiny discussion meeting. And they were talking about the things that they were excited about that was changing in their life. And I sat there and tears came into my eyes because at one point when I was trying to get sober, I had been taken to a step house near there. And that was one of the meetings they took us to. And as I sat there and listened to these people, I sat there as the woman I was 11 years ago sitting there in that room. And the woman I am today, and I understood that it is because precisely of how it was for me that I have the life I have today. You know, one of the promises in that book is that we will not regret the past. And for a lot of years, until just a few months ago, I will tell you the truth. I did. I knew I wasn't supposed to, but I did. And it was sitting in that meeting, listening to people talk about the small little joys of starting their sobriety, that gave me that feeling that, now, you know, 10 years is a long way, long time to wait for one of the promises to come true. All I have known is that if it said it in the book, sooner or later, it would be mine too. I believe that of this program, it has happened for me time and time again. Time went by in my life, and I ended up coming to in a room in downtown Long Beach. I was passed out in a hall. I was black and blue. There were people stepping over me. I had apparently been laying there for days. And as I sat up and I looked around one more time, I thought, you know, I know what is wrong here in my life, and I had a solution for it. And I have always been able to come up with solutions. They have always been the wrong ones. And as I looked around, I thought the problem here is all these junkies I am living with. You know, it is no wonder that I am always in trouble. And I have always liked looking at things that day. If I wasn't sponsored by a strong woman, I would still try and do it. You know, I always liked it being conditions and circumstances. I always figured it was the cops. It was no money. You know, it was bad luck and bad timing. I knew for certain that it was crummy karma. You know, but it wasn't me. And that's the way it was that day. And I thought, if I just get away from here, then surely things have got to improve for me a little. And I did that. There's ways that was hard to do. And there's ways it was real simple. I can tell you, no one asked me to stick around just a little bit longer, because no matter what else I had ever done, there was never a time when I didn't drink, and there has never been anything I can do about my behavior. My mouth is bad, and my behavior is violent when I drink. And I once spent a month up in Sybil Brant at the L.A. County Women's Jail with a front tooth knocked out. I was yellow. It was another bad time in my life. And as I sat there, I thought, you know, any minute, you know how good you think your friends are out on those streets. I thought, any minute someone is going to come and get me. You know, they're going to bail me out. And, you know, over a month later, I was sitting there, and I was still waiting for rescue. There wasn't anyone that wanted to claim me. And so that's the way it had been. It had been that way for a while. And I ended up, after a period of time, in North Long Beach, and I went out and I found a job. And I'll tell you, I meant to keep that job. I wanted to make things right. And whatever our story may be, and they can be very different on the surface, I wanted to keep it. I wanted to make things right. You know, I was never able to keep the promises I made to myself, much less to you. I was never able to do it, but I meant to. I was fired less than 3 months later from that job as I walked in there at 8 o'clock in the morning, because what I drank the last three and a half years I drank was Santa Fe White Port. And I don't know if any of you have Santa Fe out here in Georgia, but you probably wouldn't admit to drinking it if you had it here. They could smell it coming, and they fired me right away. I went back to that little room I was living in with this money they had given me, and I continued to drink around the clock. And I don't know how much time went by. And I only mention it because now I was coming to the end. I didn't have anyone left this time that I could turn to for any help. My family had shut the door on me years before. They were so ashamed of what I had become. And I would sit there and drink and think, you know, today is going to be just like yesterday. And yesterday was no good. And tomorrow is going to be just like today, and it's no good either. I was 27 years old, and I was waiting to die. There wasn't anything left I could do about myself. I shook all the time, and I was terrified. I was absolutely alone. You know, there's a section of our book that talks about coming to the jumping off place when we can't imagine our life any longer with our drinking, and yet we cannot imagine our life without it. And that was the way I felt. I felt absolutely terrified by everything in this world, and there was nothing left for me to do about it. And it was during that period of time that I came to the moment that I remember for myself. When I read the phrase in our book, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization because I got down to that little street corner sometime one day needing to cross it to get to that liquor store. And as I stood on that corner, I began shaking, and I wrapped my arms around myself, and I stood on that corner, and I cried because I was terrified to just cross the street. And it was a little street. See, in the end, that was what it had all come down to. I was a grown woman, and I couldn't take care of myself anymore. And I wasn't tragic, and there wasn't anything anything romantic about it, because we sometimes sentimentalize ourselves. You know, I was pitiful. And when I can see myself precisely as I was before I got to you, that has brought with it for me a measure of humility. I don't know how much time went by and how much time I spent in those last days in those in that condition. I would drink and pass out and come to and drink again. I know I came to on what later turned out to be a Sunday morning. And as I did, I reached for that pint to bring it to my mouth. And as I did, something happened to me. And it was simply that as I sat there, I saw myself for the very first time in my life precisely as I was. And I wasn't any of the things I had ever told myself. You know, I have always been able to live in fantasy. When I don't like where I am, I just go away. And I didn't do that morning, because what I saw sitting in that chair was what brought me to you. And what I saw sitting there was simply a hopeless, helpless, alcoholic woman. I saw a drunk, period. And that was the beginning for me. I never know the difference between beginnings and endings, even today. All I ever know is the pain or the sickness or the hurt of something that's ending. It never occurs to me that nothing ends, but that something else doesn't begin. That is how life is. I have to believe that it is a gift for me to sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because of what I did next. I found a dime, and I went to a payphone in the building next door, and I dialed information for the number of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I still don't know why I did that. You know, until I learn differently, I have to believe that somewhere, at some time, I sat in some little bar room or some little motel, and someone sat with me, and they talked to me about a place for people like me to come, and they called it Alcoholics Anonymous. All I know is that the name was there when I needed it, and it has been that way for me ever since. A woman came and picked me up and took me to my first meeting. And I can't remember it. I wouldn't leave with her till I finished that pint. And she held to help hold me upright in my chair. All I know is that when she dropped me off, she said, you know, Johanna, you should not be alone. She said, I want to come back here tonight and take you to a woman's recovery house. And I didn't know what she was talking about. I had never heard of such a thing. And she explained it to me. She said it was a place where a group of women lived together. And she said they didn't drink and they tried to help each other. And I thought that was one of the most appalling ideas that I had ever heard. You know, the last place on this earth I wanted to be was with a lot of women who weren't drinking. she came back that night anyhow. Now, that woman knew what service was. And she picked me up. And all I know is that I left with her. I don't know why I did that either. And she took me out to a little step house out in Belfar, a little town just north of Long Beach. And she introduced me to the house mother of this little step house. It was a tiny little place. There were maybe 7 beds there. And this woman's name was Big Betty, and she is still sober. And I will never know a woman that has more love for the sick alcoholic than she did. She walked up to me. You know, Big Betty must be 6'3". I bet she weighs about 300 pounds. And she's real intimidating if you're new. And and you're skinny and you're real sick, you know. And she walked up to me and she put her arms around me. And she just held me. And she said, honey, it is going to be okay. And I have never forgotten how good she made me feel. Those women put me to bed, and I laid there, and I hallucinated. I was very sick. And sometime in the next 48 hours, I left. I left because I needed a drink a lot more than I needed you. My sobriety date is almost a year from my first meeting. And the only thing I was to do right in that next year was to keep drifting back from time to time. And I finally made a commitment to stay at that step house for 30 days. And by the time I finally did that, I had lost the ability to talk. I could no longer put my words together so they made any sense at all. I could not do it. You know, no one could have told me that I would one day stand at these podiums. And I shook. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't feed myself. And I would listen to you talk this talk and read these things. And I didn't know what any of that had to do with not drinking. I thought that was the only thing you were talking about here. I went to a book study meeting that he had at the house where a lot of men and women would come in. And this particular night, they read out of the book and talked about it. And one more time, I didn't know what you were talking about. But after that meeting, a man crossed the room to me and he shook my hand. And see, all he did was take a couple of minutes for a newcomer. And he said the most important words I have ever heard. And they're the most important words in my life tonight. He said, "Johanna, I just want to make sure you know that you don't have to live that way anymore if you don't want to." He said, "You just don't have to live that way no more." Now, see, I had heard you talk about sobriety. And I was not sure that I wanted it. I heard you talk about not drinking, and I didn't think I was going to be able to do that. But what he told me was that I didn't have to walk back out on those streets and keep doing what I had been doing to get there in the first place. And I never forgot what he said. It was that brought me to my knees in surrender some 11 months from my first meeting. And that brings me to the only thing I believe I'm obligated to talk about when I talk about Alcoholics Anonymous as a program of recovery, and that's the concept of God. I did not want to do that for a long time until I read two sentences in our literature, and it said there that when we talk about what it was like, what happened, and what we are like today, the phrase "what happened" does not refer to how we got to our first meeting or how we sobered up. It says the only meaning of that phrase is how we came to find a power greater than ourselves. And in the very next sentence, it told me I was obligated to talk about that. It was hard for me to do at one time because it made me feel too vulnerable. It has been hard for me to learn to be open with you. It has not been easy for me. When I read that, I realized that, you see, that is the center of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. That is the purpose for which it was written. That's what it says in the preface. And I will tell you how I came to find an idea of God that I could use when I was in that step house in just the condition I was in. Because we talk about it a lot, and this one night I thought, you know, if I can't find an idea of God that I can use, I am going to leave in the morning because I am wasting my time. I could not use the idea of God that I had grown up with, and that is not because it's not a good idea. I'm not saying that at all. I don't believe that. All I am saying is that at that time and in my condition, I needed something other. I needed something simple to hold on to. And I got what I needed that night simply because I asked. I do not believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is a complicated program. It is simple. That book and those words mean exactly what they say. There aren't any shadows. You know, what I had done was to surrender somewhere deep in my soul. We come here believing we are so ashamed of ourselves that we have no soul. And yet it is just that spirit, that brings us into our first meetings. And the meaning of surrender is to let go and to abandon ourselves, absolutely. And that's what I had done without even knowing that I did it. I had a feeling come over me of the immediate presence of God. You know, I was quiet for the rest of that night in that little step house, as sick and as helpless as I was. I was quiet for the first time in many years. What happened to me is what we often call here a profound experience. I have never lost that feeling. But if I tell you that, I especially for those who are new, need to say that it tells me something a little different in the back of our book. in the section titled The Spiritual Appendix. What it says there is that we experience a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery for alcoholism. And it goes on to say that we often have an experience which is educational in nature. It says it happens slowly over a period of time. Not everyone has this immediate, overwhelming feeling. I did, but it's not necessary. It says we experience a profound alteration in our reaction to life. Now that's a simple idea. Anyone can use that. It goes on to say that we see that that change in the newcomers long before they see it in themselves. And I have many times seen the look in someone else's eyes change. And I know that someone else once saw that happen to me. It goes on in our book to say that we come to realize that God is doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. And if I could do it, if I could do this tonight, I would not be here because I would not need you. I have found a way to live sitting in the meetings in this fellowship. I have needed you. And it has been in these rooms that I have found the Spirit of God. I have never sat in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous when I didn't feel that. God does for me what I cannot do for myself. And it was those ideas I used when I surrendered to this program and went through those first three steps. I don't go through the steps, but I think I should say that it has not been with willingness that I have taken any of them for the first time. You know, it has been a pain and chaos. It has driven me into the corner, and then I become willing. I held on to many of my old ideas to the bitter end. And one of my many old ideas was the idea of stealing. I saw no reason why sobriety should interfere with something I did so well. You know, it was sort of a God-given talent, I thought. And I was out one afternoon doing a little light social shoplifting, and I was caught. The circumstances could not have been more humiliating. And other than not drink, I did the only other thing that day I did right, and that was to call my sponsor and tell her what had happened. Because, you see, I was ashamed. It had been a long time since I felt ashamed about anything. And what I wanted to do was to change how I felt inside by putting something in me. That is all I have ever known to do when I don't feel good. And she said, no, what you do tonight is you sit down and you write your inventory. And she said, you do not stop until you have completed it. And you know, that's just exactly what I did. You can do an inventory that way if you want to stay sober more than you want to drink. What they told me where I got sober is that we do these steps one after another. And they used to ask me, how soon do you want to feel better? This is what we did. And so I sat there and I wrote until I was done. And I read those pages over. And when I was done, and this is why we do it on paper, because you see it's different on paper than it is in our heads. What I saw on those pages was the life of an animal. And I didn't see any way you were all going to be able to make that right. And I took those pages the next night and sat down at a table across from another person, and I read down everything I had written down. And when I was done and I walked away, I knew for myself what it means later on in chapter 5 when it talks about the sunlight of the Spirit, because then it was mine. I had done what you told me you did, and that meant, see, that I got to feel the way you told me you felt. It was mine then, and that's how this works. I went on with 6 and 7. I made my amends. I learned about 10 and 11. I learned it doesn't just take space up between 10 and 12. You know, they told me that was to be a part of my life from then on when I was new. And I did that. You know, a lot of times we don't talk about step 11, and it is, after all, a personal thing. But, you know, it's sort of like an insurance policy, and you just pay those premiums because that's what I have done since the beginning of my sobriety, and it was in the last 2 years that I found out how much it had meant, because I was in a lot of pain, and I thought my heart was breaking. And, you know, I found out, because I have just done what you told me to do a day at a time for a while, that God could and would, if sought. I understood how the steps fit together. I was told by a member, one of those old timers at my home group, to, he said, you know, Johanna, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we all have to learn how to stand up and be counted. And he said, in your particular case, I would suggest that you find a job. And that was another one of your appalling ideas. You know, what I had done once you convinced me that alcoholism was a disease was to apply for disability. Now, and I explained to this man that no one would hire me. I'm sure you've gathered by now I'm not someone that had a resume or a list of references to hand out. And he said, you're too stupid to know anything like that. He said, you go out and do the footwork, and then we'll talk about it. And, you know, he was right. Those old-timers always are, because, of course, someone hired me. And I kept that job for the next 3 years, and I only mention it, and I want to get on with some other things, only so I can tell you what it gave me, because it gave me the first I have ever known in my life of responsibility. You know, with that job, I got a paycheck, and that meant I was able to go out and rent an apartment for myself. I had never been able to do that. I opened a checking account. I was 28 years old when I got sober. I had never had one. And I literally sat and cried the first time I sat down and wrote a check to pay my own utility bill. And I know to some that sounds like a small thing, but it was a big thing to me then, and it is a big thing today. The truth, and I have had great good fortune in sobriety, is that I look back over these last years, and the milestones are all things that just sound small. You know, the truth is that it wasn't any of those bad stories I could tell, and I've got a lot of them, that brought me to my knees. It was the small things. I remember walking into that liquor store early in the morning to buy that bottle of cheap wine. I remember that look that I have seen so many hundreds of times, that look that's a mixture of pity and contempt and disgust. And all I can tell you is that for 10.5 years now, no one has looked at me that way, and I don't need any more than that to have been overpaid in Alcoholics Anonymous. All that is good in my life has come from this program. Every answer I have needed, I have found here. That this is just my experience. I came here single, and I expected to remain that way. And someone explained that to me. A group of us got together to go out to dinner before a man we know was going to speak at a meeting, and we all went out to dinner, and then we're going to go over the meeting to hear him some years ago. And as we walked, we're sitting in this restaurant, another couple walked over and sat down at a table across from us. And I sat there and looked at this couple, and it was one of those stories you can tell right away. You know, he had just picked up her. There was a bar in the restaurant, or she had just picked up him, and they'd been drinking a lot, but they were cute. They weren't obnoxious yet. And I was sort of I was getting a kick out of watching them, and I turned to this man. I said, you know, no one ever did that for me. I said, no one ever brought me to a place like this and bought me dinner. And he looked at me and he started laughing. And he said, my God, Johanna, no one ever found it necessary. And now he was right, you know. And I have had to learn how to look back and laugh. It's a healing we do when we learn to laugh at ourselves. But what I felt then when I was new was that no one would ever have me. It took me a very long time here to find a feeling of self-worth or self-esteem. It has taken me much longer than most. And I thought I was going to be single and go to work and help at the meetings and go on panels, and this was my life, and I was well satisfied with that. And a little time went by, and I was introduced to a man in my home group, and we began dating, and some 6 months later, he asked me to marry him. And another 4 months or so later, we were married. And I was 15 months sober, and he was 9 months sober. And, you know, this last May, we celebrated our 9th anniversary. And that is pretty good for two newcomers that got emotionally involved, you know. And I want to talk to you about the day I got married, because I always do. I'm a woman, and it's important to me. I walked down the aisle of that church to be married by a priest from my home group. I had a long white dress on. Now, that should never have happened for me. We had a beautiful wedding. That church was full of people, mostly members of Alcoholics Anonymous. But my mother was there. You see, I was a daughter again. My sisters were there. My brother was there. Now, he was just a few days out of the county jail. I have tried to carry this message to my brother in some hard places. He's one of those that has a hard story. And last November, I sat at a table across from him, and I knew I was looking at a dying man. I knew it. He was. I thought, you know, one more time, I'm going to sit and talk to him like I would to any drunk. And sometimes people say you can't carry the message to someone in your family. And anyhow, I sat and talked to him. I told him all the things I knew. I told him what you told me. And when I was done, I said, you know, if you ever want to go to a meeting, I will come and get you. And he looked up at me and he said, anytime you come and get me, I will go. And this last December, I sat in what was my own first home group and watched that brother of mine take a cake for 1 year. And it seems like a miracle to me that there are two of us here. Members of my family have died from alcoholism, and we are here, and it's working for us. I felt so good the day I got married. I felt so full. I walked down the aisle of that church on the arm of the man who had told me I didn't have to live that way anymore if I didn't want to. My father died as a result of alcoholism, and he did that for me. I felt like a lady. And all I mean by that is that I felt as if I could look you in the eyes, because I spent all of my life looking at the ground until I got to you. And I meant the vows I took that day. I wanted to be a good wife. I wanted it as much as I have ever wanted anything. And the hardest thing I have had to learn how to do in sobriety is how to live in peace with another human being. You know, I only thought I knew what I was doing. When things get real hard, I call my sponsor and I explain to her this man's trying to drive me crazy. And that what I would like is the name of an AA lawyer. And she's a smart woman. She says, you know, you write an inventory, and then you call me back, and then we'll talk. And so I have learned to do this. And I'll tell you, I've written many inventories since the first few, and yet they're always the same. No matter what the circumstances are, I always end up with the same thing on those pages. I find out that much, much less the rest of the 12 steps, I am failing in the first. I have forgotten that I am powerless, and my life is unmanageable. And what I have to look at is my own desire to manage and to take control. I have to look at my desire to dominate, and I have to take a look at my manipulations, my emotional dishonesty, or my greed. See, it is me. It never was you. It is me and my reaction to life. And I have finally learned that, and it has given me a lot of freedom. I expected that my husband and I were going to always trudge this road of happy destiny hand in hand. It never occurred to me it would be any other way. And a couple of years ago, my husband walked back out, and it has been a hard thing to walk through. All I have ever known is alcoholism. And he went out, and it did not look if he was going to be able to make it back. And I am not standing up here to tell his story. It's not my business to do that. But I need to tell you about me and my reactions. You know, I am centered in my home. You know, we can all be anything we want for 90 minutes at a meeting. And how I have to judge myself is how things are going at home. And it felt like it was all falling apart. I watched my husband lay on that bed and try and kick. And he couldn't get back, and he was so sick. And I just didn't know if he was going to make it. And I didn't know what to do. I just fell apart. And one more time, it was the women of Alcoholics Anonymous and some others that walked me through a very hard time. They gave to me what I could not give to myself. We need each other here so much. I learned several things from that period of time. I learned that we really only have today. I get to thinking because I love this program so much, and I still feel so hungry for it, that I am here forever. I'll always be here. And see, I don't get to know that. All I get to know is that I have a daily reprieve, contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition I have today. And I've learned if I take care of today, then I can let the weeks and the months and the years tend to themselves. I learned something else from that period of time, and that was that I have made a decision that I no longer want to sit in these meetings and pass judgment or criticize or gossip about you and the conduct of your life. I just don't want to do that anymore because I have done that. I need to know that if it was me and I had to walk back out, that you would put out your hand to help me back. I need to have that feeling. If I don't have you, I don't know what I have. Alcoholics Anonymous is the best thing that ever happened to me. I can tell you my husband is sober again, a year and a half, and we have each had to learn the lessons we have had to learn. I believe our marriage is better today than it has ever been. I love him. He is a good man. I have always been someone that's had my hand out in life for the good times and the good things. And I've had to learn to keep that hand open for the hard times and the pain, too. If I just keep walking, I'll get to the other side. And that has been what has given me some strength. I have a confidence today that pain gave me in this program and in sobriety as a way of life. Only because all I have tried to do, because I'm not special. There's nothing special about me. All I have tried to do is to do what you do just one more day. And for me, it has worked. When I was very new, someone took me to the roundup in Palm Springs. I couldn't have gone, but someone took me, and I heard a man speak at the closing meeting that year. And it will always be the most powerful talk I ever hear, because he's the one that changed me as I sat there. And that man said many, many things that day, but one of the things he said that I never forgot was that being spiritual is being wanted, needed, and loved. And I didn't understand exactly what he had meant by that, but I never forgot it. And it was 7 years ago. I was in a hospital bed down there in Orange County where we live. And I remember that man and those words, and I understood precisely what he had meant. When I was 19 years old, I had walked away from a county building down in San Diego, and I left behind a six-week-old daughter that I could not and I would not take care of. And I don't know how to tell you the anguish and the pain those circumstances have given me in my sobriety, because I could not forgive it in myself. There was no real amend I could make. I couldn't make it right. And there might be a lot of things that sound a lot worse to some others, but that was the worst for me. And what I knew, because I didn't know I was holding on to the idea of a punishing God, what I knew is that I would never have children or a family of my own. And of course, I was in that hospital room because I had just given birth to our oldest child. It was a little boy, and he was healthy. And I don't know how to tell you how much I had wanted that baby. And I was so excited I couldn't sleep all of that night. And I laid awake thinking about all the good that had come in my life since I first sat in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And now there was this little boy, and I was going to get to be a mother. And I understood, you see, that God has no reproach for anything. He has healed, and we are healed here. God draws straight with crooked lines. I can't, and he can. I understood that it was because of you that I was wanted, needed, and loved. I felt as though I had a place in this world at last, and I had been looking for that feeling all of my life. I had another little boy a few years later, and I have had to learn in sobriety how to be a mother. And I owe everything I know about being a woman or a wife or a mother to the women of Alcoholics Anonymous. and Al-Anon because I have never known how to do those things. And I had a lot of patterns to unlearn from my own childhood. And there has been a lot of pain. My children have brought me to my knees time and time again in surrender, you know. And I'm going to tell you something tonight. I know I am a good mother. You know, I am on hand. I'm not drunk. And I'm not falling down. And I'm able to take care of them. And I am so grateful to you to have had this chance. I've watched them, walked them into the first day of school. And I've taken them to their first ball games. And I watch them learn how to swim. Today, I am a woman with a family. And I don't know how to thank you for that. You know, you all took a tramp off the streets of Long Beach. And you stood me up straight. And you are teaching me how to live. I was told when I was very new to get involved in service and to stay that way. And I have done that. And I do different things, but the thing I love the most is hospital and institutional work. It is where I am at my best. And I do bedside visitation at the county hospital. I want to tell you about a woman I once talked to. And then I'm going to sit down. I'm all done. She taught me a great lesson. When we walked in, another woman and I walked up to the side of that bed to talk to her and to say the things you say to someone who is new about Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, she had blue eyes, and it was like looking at myself. I had once come to in a county hospital not knowing how I had gotten there. And we talked to her for a while, and she was yellow, and the whites of her eyes had turned orange. Her liver was distended. She was covered with wine sores and cigarette burns. She had wrists that were like straws. I've never seen wrists so thin. I'm sure, that she was younger than she looked. And she looked up at us, and she shook her head, and she said, I don't want to hear anymore. I don't need Alcoholics Anonymous. And we kept talking to her, and she said, no, I don't need AA. I know what to do when I get home to straighten out my own life. And finally, we just left her with some literature and told her that we would check back on her the following week. And we did that. And see, what I want to tell you is that that woman was right. She did not need Alcoholics Anonymous, and drinking was not her problem. Not anymore, because she was dead. She never got here. She never got to celebrate a birthday. That woman never attended a convention. She never sat down at a little meeting with a cup of coffee and made a friend. She never went out and got a job. No one in her family ever looked at her with any respect at all. She never got any of it. And I learned what I learned from her is that I either have what we have in these rooms, or I have to walk back out there tonight to precisely what I left behind for 10 years ago. And I see no reason to believe that it would ever be any different for me. Why would it? I have this, or I have nothing at all. Line repeated 4 or 5 times through our big book, and hardly a word of it has changed each time. It's a miracle for us, is that we have discovered a common solution. And some part of me has known from the very beginning, see, that that's just another way of saying that together, because we need each other so much. I need you. Together, we don't have to live that way anymore if we don't want to. I thank God, I make it real simple, and I truly mean this. I thank God for each and every one of you. I thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, Joanna, for being here and sharing with us this weekend. That was super, absolutely fantastic. I've got a note before we close. Let me read this, and then we'll close. It says, please ask everyone to vacate the room as soon as the meeting's over so the band can set up. Okay? All right, let's close the meeting in the usual manner with the Lord's Prayer, please. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.